Each day, Meron sank a little lower from the wounds he had received on the Red Road. Taita had strapped his broken ribs, and they had healed swiftly enough. He'd sewn back the torn ear, so neatly that now it was cocked only slightly awry, and Merikara thought that the half-moon scar down his cheek made him look older and more distinguished. However, the sword thrust under his arm worried even Taita. When he probed it, he knew from its angle and depth that the weapon must have penetrated Meron's lung. Twice, when it seemed to have healed over, the wound broke open again and leaked foul-smelling pus and fluid. Sometimes Meron was lucid, able to sit up and eat without assistance. Then, when the morbid humours welled up again, he sank back into semi-consciousness and fever. Merikara stayed at his bedside, changing his dressings and anointing the wound with the unguent Taita brewed for her. When Meron was stronger, she sang to him and related all the news of the city and the army. She played Beo with him and made up rhymes and riddles to amuse him. When the wound turned again, she fed him and bathed him like a baby, stroking his sweat-soaked head until he calmed. At night she slept at the foot of his bed, coming awake immediately every time he stirred and muttered in delirium. She came to know his body as intimately as if he had been her own child. She cleaned his teeth with the green twigs of the acacia tree, chewing the ends into a stiff brush with her own small white teeth. She dressed his hair, brushing it until it grew out long enough to plait again. She trimmed his nails and came to know and love the shape of his fingers, calloused by the hilt of sword and chariot reins. She scraped the wax from his ears and the dried mucus from his nostrils without the slightest revulsion. She used her own ivory comb on the soft dark hair that grew in thick clumps under his arms, curled on his chest and nestled at the base of his belly. Each morning she washed every part of him, every crease, plane and bulge of hard muscle, and mourned as his flesh melted off him in the fevers and his bones began to show through. At first she averted her eyes from his manly parts as she washed them, but soon this seemed prudish to her. Then she cupped them in the hollow of her hand and studied them closely. They invoked in her feelings of tenderness and compassion. They were so soft and warm, the skin so smooth and flawless. Then her emotions changed when she gently drew back the skin in the way that Mintaka had shown her, and the pink tip popped out, silky as an oleander petal. It stiffened and swelled in her hand until she could barely encompass its girth with her thumb and forefinger. When this happened, she felt a strange, breathless sensation and a warmth in the most unlikely parts of her own anatomy. One night, she woke with the moonlight from the window lying like a silver bar across the stone floor of the chamber. For a moment, she thought she was in her own bedchamber in the river palace of Thebes. But then she heard Meron's painful breathing, the incoherent cries inspired by his nightmare, and it all came back to her with a rush of dread. She jumped up naked from her mattress at the foot of his couch and ran to him. When she lit the lamp, she saw that his eyes were wide open but unseeing, and that his face was ashen and contorted. There was a white scum on his lips, and his body was shining with running sweat. He was throwing himself about so violently on the crumpled linen sheets that she was terrified he would injure himself further. She knew that this was the crisis that Taita had warned her to expect. "Taita!" she screamed. "Please, we need you now!" Taita's cell was across the courtyard from theirs, and he always slept with his door open so that he could hear her call. "Taita!" she shrieked again, as she threw herself across Merin's chest to restrain him. Then she remembered that the Makers had gone into the desert with Nefer and a squadron of chariots on some mysterious expedition, and it was unlikely that they would return for many days. She thought of calling Mintaka, but her chamber was at the other end of the ancient palace, and she dared not leave Meron. She was on her own. She knew that Meron's life was in her hands, and at that thought she felt her panic subside. A cool determination took its place. She lay against him and held him tightly, whispering encouragement and reassurance. After a while he calmed so that she could leave him for a moment. She went to the chest against the window wall and found the vial the Taita had left for her, mixed the pungent contents with wine, and warmed it on the brazier as he'd instructed her. When she held the goblet to Merrin's lips he tried to refuse, but she forced him to drink. When the bowl was empty, she heated water and washed the sweat from his face, the scum from his lips. She was about to wash his body when a sudden seizure racked him and he began to shake and groan. Her terror returned in full force. She flung herself onto him and clung to him with all her strength. "Do not die, my darling," she pleaded with him. And then in a stronger voice, "I will not let you die. Oh, Hathor, help me. I will drag him back from the underworld with my own hands." She knew that she was in a battle, and she fought with him, extending all her strength and adding it to his. When she felt him go limp in her arms and his sweat-drenched body start to cool, she cried out, "No, Merrin, come back to me. You cannot go without me." She placed her mouth over his and tried to breathe her own life into him. Suddenly he gave an explosive gasp, emptying his lungs, and she thought it was all over. She hugged him with both arms around his bony chest, and when she released the pressure, he took another noisy breath, then another. The flutter of his heart became a strong, regular thumping that reverberated through her frame. "You have come back," she whispered. "You have come back to me." He was still cold, and when he shivered, she held him with both her arms round his chest and wrapped her legs round his hips, warming him with her own body. Slowly, his breathing became deep and regular, and she felt the warm blood flowing back into his veins. She lay with him and felt a deep sense of fulfilment, for she knew that she had saved him, and that from this night onwards he would belong to her alone. In the dawn another miracle occurred. She felt his body awaken, and what she had once held soft and small in the palm of her hand now swelled against her once more, becoming enormous, hard as bone, pressing up between her spread thighs. She looked into his face and saw that he was conscious, his eyes dark and sunken in the wasted sockets, but with an expression of such awe and tenderness in them that her heart swelled within her chest so that she felt she might suffocate with the strength of her own torrential emotions. "Yes?" he asked. "Yes," she answered. "It is what I want more than anything else in all the world." She spread herself and reached down to guide him, aching inside with the need for him, taking him in deeply to the core of her existence, rising with him as if on wings to a place she had never been before, then crying out as she felt him fill her with a hot flood, as though she had drawn out of him and into her own body all his fever and pain and suffering, sensing the deep peace in him as he slumped against her and slept. She lay quietly beside him, careful not to disturb him, reveling in the sound of his breathing and the warmth of his thin, ravaged body, savouring the ache which he had left deep within her. She felt him coming awake and kissed him gently on the lips to welcome him back. He opened his eyes and looked into hers, first with bewilderment, and then with dawning joy as the events of the night came back to him. "I want you to be my wife," he said. "I am your wife already," she replied. "And I will be your wife until the day I die."